Balance your trading strategy by adding futures. CME Group helps you manage risk and capture opportunities in all market environments. Capitalize on around-the-clock access to highly liquid global futures and options market across all major asset classes. Just visit your online broker and get started. Plug into valuable educational materials and trading tools and see what adding futures can do for you at cmegroup.com/onthetape. iConnections is the world's largest capital introduction platform in the alternative investment industry. iConnections membership-only platform brings together the asset management community, providing allocators and managers with the opportunity to connect both physically and virtually. With an impressive network of over 4,000 allocators and 900 managers, their community oversees an astounding $48 trillion and $16 trillion in assets, respectively. iConnections is also the driving force behind the alternative investment industry's most renowned in-person events. We invite you to join iConnections at their upcoming event, SALT iConnections in New York, taking place on May 20th through the 21st at the Glass House in New York City. This two-day event is packed with one-on-one cap intro meetings and content. To explore more about iConnections events and gain access to their members-only platform, visit iConnections.io. When you're trading options, Fidelity has just what you need with straightforward but powerful tools to help you select a strategy and execute your ideas. And they offer a wide range of information and insights to help simplify your trading experience. Have a question? Ask it live during their small classes and coaching sessions. Need information? Check out their educational videos, articles, and webinars. See why it's easy to trade options your way at Fidelity. Start now at fidelity.com/options. Options trading entails significant risk and is not appropriate for all investors. Certain complex option strategies carry additional risks. Before trading options, contact Fidelity Investments by calling 800-544-5115 to receive a copy of Characteristics and Risks of Standardized Options. Supporting documentation for any claims, if applicable, will be furnished upon request.
By the way, growing up in upstate New York, like your Knicks, we weren't that focused. Like Syracuse basketball in the Big East, that was enough.
He loved Syracuse.
Do you understand what I'm saying? Like, yeah. We bleed orange. Yes. That was enough. Yes. And you know how many people from Syracuse, New York are like Cowboys fans or were like Michael Jordan slash Bulls fans?
Because it's so disconnected from New York City.
And Buffalo felt like a really weird thing. Buffalo, you guys were probably kids then, but I was in high school.
Thurman
but they
Thomas.
Went. They literally went to the Super Bowl 4 years in a row
and
lost all four.
Yeah.
They weren't like this team that like you would revere. You're like, oh, what a bunch of losers. Because the AFC kind of sucked too, right?
You understand that whole region of the country, like, it's an artifact of history that it even exists.
Yeah.
There's no reason why people would be living there.
Well, you know why? Because the Hudson River
went straight up.
And then they built the Erie Canal to the Great Lakes. And then,
it was really important to the development of America.
Albany, Syracuse, Rochester,
Buffalo. The canals were the first
blockchains. Canal was the internet. Honestly,
yeah. if you need a problem in search of it. No, I'm just kidding.
It's the opposite of blockchain. If you actually needed to move heavy things,
yeah,
you needed to move it by barge. There were no railroads.
100%.
Also, there's no refrigeration, so that's why all the meat packing is up there.
Yeah.
But that was 200 years ago. What's the reason now?
Student of history. All right, this is Josh Brown. He is the CEO of Ritholtz Wealth Management with Michael Batnick, who is a managing...
Shout to Buffalo. What's up?
managing partner at Ritholtz Wealth Management. We never pod with Barry Ritholtz, the namesake of
You'll never get a word
firm.
In.
Yeah.
Is that how it works?
Turn your mic off. Ask him one question, leave the room.
All right, but he is a prolific podcaster.
Yeah,
he does the Bloomberg Opinion, and oftentimes I'll see some really interesting takes that he has.
I think Masters in Business started like 2017? He's been doing forever.
Barry doesn't get his due for how forward-thinking he's always been. He was the first financial blogger. Literally, look it up.
Yeah.
That's number one.
Number two,
he's one of the first bloggers, not just finance, but period, to take a blog audience and do a live event around it.
Yeah.
Like, this predates Kara Swisher. This predates anyone that's done it since.
The Big Picture Conference.
And the interview format podcast predates pretty much every single one in finance. None still live that started before.
Yeah.
And I don't think anyone has done it to that level.
Was he before Invest Like the Best?
Definitely.
Yeah.
I think Patrick was inspired by Masters.
Shout out to Barry.
But my point is, as many words that come out of Barry's mouth a minute, and it's a lot,
yeah,
you will never hear him ever say what I just said
yeah.
about his own shit.
I want to talk about this, the business of this. The three of us have talked about this a bunch and like what inspired us to do some of the things that we're doing, besides the fact the things that we do in the markets every day. And I think that's really interesting. So again, Ritholtz Wealth Management, you guys are an asset management firm, but you guys also are a very media forward sort of business.
So you were going to say very mediocre.
No, I was
very
not going to say that.
Very media forward.
No, I mean, you really are. And so when you talk about inspirations, all that stuff's really interesting. Just to, as a quick housekeeping here, we're going to hit a lot of market stuff here. We're recording this on the day that the Fed is going to be giving their presser after their two-day meeting. We know what's happened with expectations for rate cuts. They have been pushed out. When the stock market started to rage in mid-December when he had that presser, I think it was deck 13 or something like that, the markets were pricing in, what, six cuts in 2024. Right now, we are not expecting a cut until the June meeting.
What markets were cutting in, were pricing in six cuts? The bond market.
Yeah, the bond market.
Not the stock market.
Stock market too, maybe.
Stock market really did. But all right, we're going to hit all that.
Every rate cut expectation that gets taken away, the stock market goes up another 5%.
I know, and we're going to debate that.
That's true, but it's also true. That was the meeting where it was like, we're done raising, and the market took off.
That was the clarity on the pause.
Correct.
Which means, finish that thought. So what does that mean?
I don't know, genius. What does it mean?
I don't know, but I would infer from the stock market's perspective, cuts are fine whenever they come.
Yeah.
No one's screaming for one, not really affecting anything that matters. It's a small cap issue. No rush.
Yeah.
The market has said, we're good with the no hiking. It's like enough.
John, the interesting thing now is that the further these rate cuts get pushed out, market doesn't care.
The market's
still going up.
Didn't we say it's this asymptotic thing where they'll never come, but it's always going to be an upside catalyst? So it's actually better if you never get a rate cut. And the market just keeps looking forward to it.
Oh, that's right.
Yeah, and listen, I think we've all discussed this, some of the kind of secular trends.
Isn't the anticipation of everything better than the thing itself? When you and I are going to Four Charles, the food's amazing, but it's never better than the moment you sit down.
Four Charles it is.
Most things, though, I can't wait to go to that concert. And then you go, it's like, all right, concert was great, but like the buildup is better.
Yeah,
the rate cuts are becoming that for the stock market. It's like anything could go wrong, but remember, the Fed has seven rate cuts in its pocket.
Yeah, but the one thing is that now you're starting to hear that we've actually had the expectations for cuts been cut in half and then pushed out to the second half of the year. Now you're starting to hear even like some very bullish strategists say when they finally cut, it's not going to be for good reasons. That's what we're going to be dealing with a lot over the next few months or so, especially if some of the data starts to slow. And
Let me ask you this. So you think that they're more likely to do an emergency rate cut than, all right, we're good, we can cut now?
I think emergency rate cuts, and I remember what it was like, let's say in 2001, when they did these emergency cuts.
Let me rephrase that. Not emergency, but in response to weakening conditions.
Oh, I think that would be very bad. It would show a level of panic. And, and one thing I will say is I think you have to go back and look at the history of Fed Chair Powell when he came in. Remember, they were calling it autopilot, the way he was raising interest rates. And I think a lot of folks were like, yeah, man, that's the way you should normalize interest rates, be very forward as far as the way you communicate with investors and the like here. And he was doing a really good job until the stock market fell out of bed in late 2018. You remember that two and a half month period, and then they basically stopped the hikes, right? And then they moved to a more easy stance.
But that wasn't bad. 2019, the S&P did 30%.
They stopped
hiking.
Oh, that's my point, though. Yeah. The start of the rate cuts is not negative. 2019, you had three rate cuts in the first 6 months, and the market rallied 30% that year. And there was good reason to cut. There was a trade war with China. There were all sorts of manufacturing-related issues. There was a pronounced amount of panic in the markets toward the end of the year. We actually bottomed on Christmas Eve.
Yep.
They weren't doing emergency rate cuts like there was an economic crash.
Well,
they just said, we're tighter than we need to be, and the rhetoric has been way too hawkish. See, here are some rate cuts, and the market loved it.
See, I disagree. When you say tighter than we need to be, that's assuming that it did some damage to the economy, that it slowed it up. The worry at the time was twofold. It was risk asset prices, the way they were dropping
precipitously. That's not in the Fed's mandate.
No, I understand, but that was clearly the reason they did it for, and there was some worry about global growth, because it wasn't issues about growth here in the U.S., but the U.S. stock market started to actually price in the risk that it was going to be imported, that weakness here. That's my two cents. And when you go back, and it's interesting that you mentioned that we were in a trade war with China. Look at the two things that happened. As the Fed was raising interest rates in 17 and 18 on autopilot, we did have tariffs, we did have this trade war, but we also had this massive tax cut. right? And so there were two different things at play here. So I just think it's interesting. And those are things that are not in the Fed's purview. Stable prices are. I think that if Guy were here, he would tell you, and one of those stable pricings has been for risk assets. I know that's not what the mandate suggests, but stable prices in the stock market. And that's what they, in my opinion,
it's not in the PCE other than the fees that fund managers charge. Stable prices aren't in there. I think it's a little bit simpler. I basically think the Fed said something ridiculous around Thanksgiving in 2018. They said we are nowhere near, quote, nowhere near neutral, meaning they had a ton left to go. The asset price markets, to your point, responded really negatively to that. I think that did force the Fed to rethink making statements like nowhere near neutral. And then as the yield curve starts to invert into 2019, they know definitively that they're too tight. So you get these rate cuts, and I just don't think the market took that as, oh, wow, look, Powell thinks there's an emergency. And I bring this up. It's 6 years ago, so who gives a shit? But I bring this up because I do think that's going to be relevant this time. If and when the Fed does the first cut, I don't agree that necessarily means the Fed is going to interpret that as, uh-oh, we're in trouble. I could be wrong. It's just not my base case right now.
So interesting. And again, why are we looking back at 6 years ago and looking how this Fed
cutting cycle?
Yeah. And to me, I do think it's what's very different this time, Mike, is that the Fed was dying to get up to 2% inflation back then, if you think about it. And now Fed Chair Powell has told us that they're not going to wait to get to their 2% target to start cutting rates, right? They're going to anticipate it. And that's what I think, again, by the time you're listening to this, we're going to know what Fed Chair Powell had to say and a little bit of the Q&A and that sort of thing. But again, I don't think any of us right here expect to be too surprised by this, and especially when you're starting to look and see what the bond market is pricing for cuts. But Josh had this post on the Instagram, Mike, and I'd love for you to opine on this. He said, Wall Street says inflation, they're defining it in the terms of the rate of change from last month. When Main Street says it, they're referring to the current cost of living, not focused on the pace,
yes,
but on the price itself. Yes. And I think this is going to be squarely the debate, right? And I think you really summed that up really well in an Instagram post. But now I want to hear what Mike Bagnett has to say about that.
No, Josh is absolutely right. People don't care. Regular people don't care whether CPI or PCE or X shelter or whatever. They don't care what it did month over year. What normal people are looking at is, holy shit, can't fucking believe how much things cost compared to a couple of years ago. That's it. They feel cumulative inflation. So when they see economists and Fed speakers debating about this, it's like maddening. It's what planet are you people living on?
Yeah.
So I also think just in terms of the Fed, and obviously we have to talk about it, they're a big player on the field. They're going to potentially move the market later today or not. We'll see. I think it's probably they're not going to surprise anybody. The more likely you are to spend time focusing on the Fed and what they might or might not do, the more likely you are to twist yourself into a pretzel and cause yourself a lot of anxiety and probably not do yourself any favors when it comes to your own investing portfolio.
So let me ask you this, though. And again, some of the data suggests, at least the economic data, that maybe the U.S. economy is slowing a little bit at a time where inflation is firming up, or at least the rate of decline. And again, the cumulative thing is really important. So, Josh, how do you guys think about that a little bit? Because that is the push and pull right now, is about if we do see an unemployment rate at some point over the course of the summer get up above 4% or something like that, and we do see inflation also, do we start pricing in what a stagflationary environment looks like for the stock market?
Don't say the S word.
Yeah. No, but it's been 50 years, like in our lifetimes, we have not had to deal with that. And I do think it's interesting that some of the secular trends in technology, right? Pre-pandemic automation, we were talking about universal basic income. We were talking about all these sorts of things, right? And now here we are on the cusp of one of the biggest paradigm shifts in not just in technology, but what might do to the global economy here. And one that will be, on one level, very deflationary, right? If you think about it, and then on other levels, it could be not. And one of the areas that you just mentioned, or we haven't really mentioned, is like wages. When you think about it as a component of services inflation, that may stay very well bid for knowledge workers, right? And then if immigration continues to be an issue, maybe we have it on the lower end of the employment spectrum also.
We've actually had a huge influx of legal immigration, illegal also, which infuriates people. And with good reason, but we've actually starting to recover the level of legal immigration. We went through a period leading up to the pandemic of virtually no immigration, and then it became actually no immigration. And however you feel about that, it's not a political debate. It's the reality of what that does at service sector jobs, manufacturing jobs. It turns out we need a certain amount of immigration just for our companies to run themselves properly. So we're now healing on the legal immigration front, and that has absolutely had an effect on ameliorating the wage price spiral that we were all worried about.
You're less worried about that becoming embedded.
Look, I think the reality is that when you talk to regular people about the rate of inflation in the grocery store and how much it costs to eat out, first of all, we forget that 30, 40 years ago, most families couldn't afford to eat out. It was a special occasion. Now you have families that eat out five nights a week, like it's coming to them, right? But their parents, and definitely not their grandparents, did not live a lifestyle where eating out on a regular basis was something. So we all get used to things that are relatively new. These things become embedded in our quality of life.
Luxuries turn into necessities.
Yeah. None of us want to give back. So if you're somebody that flew coach your whole life, and then in your 40s you said, you know what, I don't do this shit anymore, I need to sit first class, and then all of a sudden circumstances make it so that you have to go back to coach, you are not going to be a happy camper. Okay. This is the environment that we're in right now, and the one thing that people don't remember, or they don't put two and two together, is the fact that there have been huge gains in wages, especially at the lower end of the distribution. This is something that people really don't want to hear. Hey, you know why there's inflation? Because everyone in your income cohort is making 20% more than they were prior to 2020. And spending in a way that they were never able to spend. You're the inflation. Go fucking say that to somebody. See how they like it.
Well, you can't talk about inflation without talking about assets, without talking about income.
Yeah.
Dude, it's the same disconnect. I'm sorry. It's the same disconnect as when you talk to a boomer about the first home they bought and they're still in it. And they delight in telling you, I bought that house for $40,000 cash.
Yeah.
Right? And then they tell you today it's worth $400,000. You're like, all right, but that's 1% a year.
Isn't the setting up
plus, for this plus you paid taxes, plus you renovated it three times, plus everything that broke you had to fix, you really think is the greatest investment you've ever made?
Right.
So when you introduce like data and inflation adjust things to people, like all of a sudden this thing that's like glowing in their consciousness, like how great they picked something to do, it's like, oh, shut up. By the way, nobody likes data. And my wife does that. I tell her how much money I made. She goes, yeah, we lose half in taxes. Yeah. Thank you so much for that reminder. Yeah. I appreciate it.
What about consumer credit? So when you think about this, like Josh just made the case basically that people are spending on things that generations ago or decades ago, they just weren't spending on a regular sort of basis. So when you think about what we've achieved as far as wage gains and maybe what might be inflecting as it relates to immigration, and we might be doing a lot better than a lot of our developed peers on this idea of this population decline. When you think about it, what do you make? How do you throw in the data as it relates to consumer credit and where we are right now relative to the sorts of spending that we're seeing? And listen, this is on a day like today where, you know, a lot of folks want to look at the lower end sort of stuff. Some of the stuff that we heard out of Dollar Tree and Dollar Gen over the last couple of weeks.
That's specific to those industries.
It is. But then on a day like today, I think Gucci in Europe is down 15% over some of the things that they're seeing in luxury. So I'm just curious, how does consumer credit factor?
Those are all specific industries and things that are idiosyncratic to those companies. If you listen to Bank of America or Ally, big financial institutions that are serving everyone, not just LVMH, they all say the same thing. Visa, American Express, obviously higher end, they all say the same exact thing. Consumer credit, the consumers are healthy, spending is robust, they continue to spend. Listen, it's not going to be this way forever. You're not saying like things will always be this good, but right now things are good and we could celebrate that.
No, I agree. All right, so let's look at something on the consumer end. So we're seeing Capital One made a bid for Discover, okay? When you think about that, one of the areas, they're going to take out thousands and thousands of jobs. Then they're going to integrate generative AI tools to help accelerate that sort of thing. And I look around and I say to myself, how many industries are going to be disrupted like this?
All of them.
And so I guess the point that I want to make really
is it doesn't have to be bad.
Is disruption good or bad?
It doesn't have
to be bad. Well, the way that technology is accelerating right now, so we could have made these same arguments. If you were like a forward thinker in 1998 and you saw all these companies going public, it was eBay, it was Amazon. So e-commerce was going to get disrupted by those two companies. And you could look ahead and say things like email were going to be this massively productive sort of tool. And there's a whole host of things.
Dude, look what happened to the malls. Are we any worse off because malls blew up because brick and mortar borders were severely disrupted because Bed and Bath isn't here anymore?
Yeah.
Are we, as a society, are we worse off because
of
that?
No, I mean, but Amazon finally fulfilled that promise. If you think about it, because like you guys, we're sitting right above what was the biggest Bed Bath and Beyond in America, and it's empty right now down below us. And this was 2 years after the CFO of that company, sadly, threw himself out of a window. Because remember that? Because things were so bad here in New York. And to your point, it's like that scene in Jerry Maguire when he finally like leaves and everyone stops and he's
who's coming with me?
And everyone stops and it's this poignant moment. And then, you know, the one woman gets in, he gets in the elevator and everything goes back to normal. That's really
where we are. It's not good or bad. Yeah. It's good and bad, right? There will be great things and there will be terrible things for individuals. But as a whole, I tend to be more optimistic than glass half full, this is the end of society, we're all fucked.
No, I don't think that either.
It's a culling.
Yeah.
It's the shittiest companies don't make it. This is not new. You could argue that maybe the pace is faster, although the credit markets for high yield debt would disagree with you. But lower quality businesses that don't survive, it's every era, every new technology, every interest rate regime, every economic cycle. It's an endless parade of brand names that one day it felt like they were one of the most important companies in America. Everyone could sing along to the commercial jingle.
Yeah.
You knew their colors, you knew their logo. And then the next day they were gone and life went on. And so if you are a low quality operator or you have a management team that doesn't figure out the next technological shift and get ahead of it, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, eventually you lose.
Yeah, and listen.
But somebody new comes.
We will never stop coming up
with new ways to spend surplus money on leisure, on necessities, on goods, on services.
It's
we
like
will
positive
never stop.
Cannibalization.
Listen, in the stock market, and I want to talk about valuation, Mike, because you had a really great post on the Irrelevant Investor earlier in the week, and we're going to put that in the show notes about valuation. But again, this AI trade is going to broaden out dramatically.
It's a lifestyle.
Listen, it's going to broaden, but my point is it's going to broaden out. At some point, people are going to be looking at industries that we haven't focused on a whole heck of a lot. And then there's going to be, how do you get this thing that trades at 13 times as a sector up to, let's say, a market multiple? And it's going to be all these narratives in around generative AI and productivity gains and all that. Like that's what comes next. And we saw that in the dot-com thing. But let's go to valuation for a second here before we talk about some of those industries. Mike, you made the point in your post, and it was, why are U.S. stocks so expensive? Make the case of like why this kind of was on the tip of your tongue earlier on in the week, because a lot of folks have looked at a lot of these names, some of the early beneficiaries, at least, and why Microsoft at 35 times is fine, why NVIDIA had grown into that 35 times multiple, especially given the growth. And we know that also at the lows in 2022, if you X'd out those top 10 tech stocks, most of the S&P was trading at a trough multiple. So like that's really important. So why valuation, not a good timing tool.
The worst.
Why did it hit your radar this week?
For the last 15 years, anybody that has said anything about valuation has lost money.
Yeah.
And I'm not saying that that's a great investment thesis, not to worry about valuation. Of course,
you think from a macro standpoint.
I'm just saying if you're waiting for things to return to the way that they used to be. I used to be able to buy IBM when IBM was a great company at 16 times earnings.
Yep.
That doesn't exist anymore for a myriad of reasons. Of course, one of them is the fact that people are treating their 401k as a savings vehicle as much as it is about an investing vehicle.
And well, explain that for a second.
So these people are not price sensitive. And again, this is not an index. This is not an active passive thing. It's I'm saving for my retirement. And every 2 weeks, if stock market is at the all-time high or if it's crashing, every 2 weeks, I'm going in there.
Yeah.
And that has a fundamental impact on the stock market. I can't quantify.
It's trillions of dollars.
I can't quantify what it is other than to say that is definitely one of the reasons why the CAPE ratio has been so abnormally high, not the last 3 years, for the last 20 years. Even in 2000.
Do your clients care about valuation? That's another question.
Not everybody cares about valuation.
But we have to talk about these things a lot. You guys have mics in front of your face three times a week. This is just your podcast. Then Josh, I know you and I are on CNBC a few times a week or whatever. When you're trying to demystify some of these topics, as you do very well in your blog posts and on your pods, Mike, you have to come up with different things that help contrast this sort of stuff. And so one of the things that we've always used as a bit of a, you can call it whatever it is valuation, comparative valuation, whether it be a market, whether it be an individual name, whether it be sectors within
the
markets, that sort of thing.
When you're looking at the price to earnings ratio on Yahoo Finance, do you think that there's an edge? Do you think that there's any information in there? I think all of the stuff that we're talking about, while fun to debate, it is a major distraction to what ultimately drives the stock market. It's very simple. It's earnings.
On the halftime report and on Fast Money, if we are totally going to disregard valuation as like an input, as a talking point,
I don't think disregard is the right way. What are you left to? No, the question is, when Mike says the term CAPE ratio, let's define what that means. Yeah. This was the heart of the debate over the last 15 years. All the people that know more than everyone else were very hung up on this idea that if you pay too high of a valuation for the market relative to its own history of valuation, mm-hmm. that you're in for nasty trouble. That was what you were told by the village elders, and you listened to them. And if you did, you missed out on the second best bull market ever. What were they seeing that ended up not mattering? They were seeing a market 20 years ago that was selling at an elevated multiple on 10 years worth of earnings. Mm-hmm. So that's season. They're taking out the cycle, and they're saying, on average, this is what the S&P 500 usually sells at.
And what were the biggest stocks? It was Walmart and Exxon and Johnson, right. and Chevron. And this is not Apple. This is not Google.
So this is what they missed. And it's not their fault. They presupposed that the next 10 years, from 2012 to 2022, they presupposed that 10-year period forward would look a lot like every other 10-year period throughout history. And here's what was different. The internet and cloud computing enabled businesses like Apple, Microsoft, yeah. Amazon, Alphabet, Meta to run 40% growth and 50% profit margin for years and years and years. And that should not have happened if you're a student of history. It never happened. Or if it did happen, it was one select company for 1 year. This happened for the five biggest companies for 10 years.
Yeah.
So what do you want these people to do? It's not their fault. They trapped themselves in this paradigm. And what they didn't understand was that the market was no longer comprised by businesses with 5% profit margins and 8% growth.
Yep.
That's the old S&P 500.
So valuation definitely matters, but you can't talk about inflation without talking about income, and you can't talk about valuation without talking about earnings and margins. So my point is not that I would prefer the stock market to be at high valuations, but I think that for most regular people, if you think, uh-oh, stocks are expensive, what do I do? Mm-hmm. You lower your expectations.
Yeah.
That's what you do. You don't say, I don't want to own stocks today. You just say, okay, stocks have done 14% of the year for the last decade. I'm probably not going to get that for the next decade.
Yeah.
Maybe I'll get 6%.
Yeah, listen, I don't know if you guys recall this. I think it was late March of last year. We were on here, we were debating some of these very same issues, right? And it was a different market. It was right after the Silicon Valley Bank.
It was
right after a bear market in 2022 that I think was something that was very unusual to most folks. You know what I mean? Because if you blinked in February or March of 2020, you missed that 35% drawdown in the S&P 500, right, during COVID. And so we hadn't had a proper sell-off in stocks in a very long time or so. And one of the things that I said is, listen, I'm on a show called Fast Money.
We were still in a bear market. Sorry to cut you off, but we were still very much in a bear market in March 2023.
Yeah. No, listen, like a lot of folks were doubling down on their multi-year down for the markets and that sort of thing. I was not particularly optimistic by any means whatsoever. And I think one of the last things I said is, listen, if I'm you two, and I'm like at Ritholtz Wealth Management, and I'm talking to your audience, but I'm not, like, I'm at Fast Money. I have this Mike, we're doing things real time and this and that, whatever. I grew up in the business trading stocks, long, short, trading options, trading futures, doing all this sort of thing. So my lens is very different. But I said, this is what I'd be doing if I think about all these secular trends. We were talking about ChatGPT-4, and at the time, I had no idea it was going to do the things that it was for the picks and the shovels and what it meant for NVIDIA having a hold on this GPU market where all of their competitors were left flat-footed, not anticipating, including Apple computer. Yeah. Think about it. Apple had no generative. They were still building a car, right? Like that they just scrapped. So I guess my point right there is, what did I say to you guys at the time? What I would do? Q's and twos. I would just say, like, I had the same
advice.
Amount yeah. of QQQ every week or every month or whatever that period is, whether it's up 40%, whether it's down 40%. And that's the thing that I think, to your point about the 401k as not just an investment vehicle, but as a saving vehicle, that's the thing. But I guess, like, we have lots of folks that come to us. They're in it for the sport.
Yeah.
They love this sort of
stuff. Dude, we love the game. I love it.
Yeah.
I buy and hold stocks. I love it. I think that just looking inside the market right this second, it's Wednesday, March 20th at 11:35. What are, like, the short-term risk that your audience might be into, like this might be catnip for them. It's that you've got the VIX, where is it, 12 or whatever it is. You've got fund manager survey, pretty damn elevated.
Yeah.
You have the bull bear spread. There's no bears to be found, highest level of bulls since 21 or 22 or whatever, something like that. You have unemployment about the economy, it's Goldilocks. And then you have the stock market breaking out. You have basically every sector is trading higher. There's no credit spreads are as tight as they can possibly be. Yeah. There's no fear whatsoever in the market. And that's not a bad thing.
Yeah.
That's not a bad thing. But I'm just saying, if there could be something that people could point to and say, where's the next 5% downside risk? What's this? It's something could very easily knock us off course.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think you should be rooting for that. If you're listening to this podcast and you're 78 years old, it's likely that all the money that you'll ever make and invest is already in the market. So I apologize if you don't like what I just said. For everyone else who's listening, I think you should be rooting for the next negative catalyst. If you're a force saver and you're putting money into the market every 2 weeks, no matter what, why are you rooting for higher prices? I've never understood that mentality.
Well, you know why? Because psychologically, people like to see their accounts
at all-time highs. So psychologically, people should think, hey, if the market comes down and I'm not using money anyway, I'm way better off buying lower than higher.
Well, there's two things. Number one, people like seeing their account at new highs, obviously. They don't like to see themselves lose money. And it's not just the first 5% that they're worried about. Whenever we get a 5% pullback, you're afraid it's going to turn into a 10% and it just cascades.
Agree. And that's why we have a job. And I think one of the things that we have done over the last 10 years since we founded the firm is we didn't allow people who are working with us to engage in worst case scenario fantasies.
Yeah.
We help people tune out the people for whom they never woke up and said a positive thing about the market. The media will continue to book those people. They get a lot of attention. They generate a lot of clicks.
There's not many of them, Josh.
There's not.
I get tagged as one of those people, but you and I, we've had this conversation.
No, you're not one of those people.
No, but we get, listen, like I know who I am in the market. Do you know what I mean? I know who I am as a pundit. And again, one of the reasons that I've taken a little bit of this heel thing, and I've been doing CNBC now for almost 15 years,
that.
Is that when I started doing it, listen,
You think that you're the villain on CNBC?
Dan is the heel.
On our program, and I always
you
have
do?
Been. Yeah, oh, no doubt. Oh, you.
I never picked up
do
on
you
that.
Watch, you don't watch Melissa?
I
look
watch
at me
all the time.
And she comes. I know, but she comes to me. And listen, I enjoy it. I don't mind because
Your role is to pour water on anything that sounds like
it's not even a role. I'm not saying it's like when I started doing it, 94% of the people that would come on those programs were just telling really nice stories about whether individual names, about markets, about economies, about market participants. And that's fine. Listen, you just said yourself as an optimism. I am an optimist, but people who only know me from Fast Money over the last 15 years thinks I'm probably the most dour guy you've ever met. We've all hung out
but it's also
away from the market.
It's different time horizons.
Well, no, but my point is like I grew up in this business in the late 90s and I was a bull market baby, man. Like I was trading the XCIT, the AOL, the YHOO, and we were trading them both ways. And I was optimistic about what those companies presented for the economy, what they presented for the markets. And that was obviously a massive paradigm shift. And I guess the only point that I'm trying to make is I came into this business. If you were bullish on something, you better know what the opposite part of that story would be, how that trade or that investment could go pear-shaped. So that's what I like to try to articulate, you know what I mean, as we're doing the pods, as we're doing the shows. That's how I'll be helpful
but you
to
said,
investors.
You said yourself, like part of this is for sport and for hobby and enjoyment and the love of the game. And that's what I do with my fun-ish account.
Yeah.
Now it's a little bit more money than like fun money. It's like a decent amount of change. But also, I also have my 401k and my IRA and my taxable every
geared
month.
Every,
and that is buy, hold forever, don't do anything ever. And then I have this part of it where I am having fun because I love to do it.
You want to hear something funny? I had two people that when I started in the business, I had two people pull me aside and let me in on a secret. And one of them is no longer in the industry. He lives in Boca now. He is like in the health food business. But he was like the top producer at the first firm I ever worked at. And I was not managing money or anything. I was just a cold calling stockbroker. And I asked him what he does with his own money. Because we were trading Asian technology stocks that we were making markets in, right? And they were rips. You would sell a $9 stock that your trading desk owned for $7.50. It'd be $1.50 in the middle. Mm-hmm. The firm would take half. The broker would take half.
Mm-hmm.
This was the business. Mm-hmm. It's not that we didn't believe in the stocks. It's that for some reason, everyone was selling the same stocks.
Well, back then, it was sport. Let's be clear.
But my point is, so this guy would just be the most incredible producer selling companies, Flextronics, Smart Modular.
Mm-hmm.
These were basically Asian
contract
companies, but with a U.S.-based management team, on the New York Stock Exchange or on the NASDAQ. If they were on the NASDAQ, you knew it was a honeypot for the brokers. Anyway, I said, what do you do with the money? He just punches up an index fund. There were no ETFs at the time. Yeah. So he just shows me an S&P 500 index fund. And he said, every month, all the money I don't spend goes right into this. And somebody told me to do that 10 years ago. And that's all I've ever done. And that's all I really do. And that insight squared with something that I heard 10 years ago from someone who was very senior at Vanguard, who was dealing with hedge fund managers, macro, the bears, the guys that were trading currencies, this and that. And he said, it's so funny. I hear this guy come out and predict all this shit. And then I look at how he's actually, what he's doing with his own money. And it's just VOO.
Yeah.
It's literally just buy the market, buy it over and over again. So it just seems to me that there's tons of reasons to be bearish. There's tons of reasons to think that there's going to be a correction or a short-term market issue. But if you actually look at what people do in real life,
yeah,
real people put money to work and leave it alone.
With CME Group's micro-sized futures and options, you can access the same transparency and liquidity of the benchmark contracts with less upfront financial commitment. Diversify your portfolio and manage your exposure with the flexibility of CME Group micro contracts in crypto, metals, FX, energy, and equity indices. Learn more about what adding futures can do for you at cmegroup.com/micros. iConnections is the world's largest capital introduction platform in the alternative investment industry. iConnections' membership-only platform brings together the asset management community, providing allocators and managers with the opportunity to connect both physically and virtually. With an impressive network of over 4,000 allocators and 900 managers, their community oversees an astounding $48 trillion and $16 trillion in assets, respectively. iConnections is also the driving force behind the alternative investment industry's most renowned in-person events. We invite you to join iConnections at their upcoming event, Salt iConnections in New York, taking place on May 20th through the 21st at the Glass House in New York City. This two-day event is packed with one-on-one cap intro meetings and content. To explore more about iConnections events and gain access to their members-only platform, visit iConnections.io.
Trading options might be new for you, or maybe you've been doing it for a while. Either way, Fidelity is your go-to source for clear and relevant information about trading options. For example, ask Fidelity professionals questions during their live small classes and coaching sessions and learn more with educational videos, articles, and webinars. Plus, with Fidelity's straightforward tools and technology, you'll find it easier than ever to trade options your way. See what's waiting for you at fidelity.com/options.
Options trading entails significant risk and is not appropriate for all investors. Certain complex option strategies carry additional risks. Before trading options, contact Fidelity Investments by calling 800-544-5115 to receive a copy of Characteristics and Risks of Standardized Options. Supporting documentation for any claims, if applicable, will be furnished upon request.
So I have one thing that makes me very nervous right now. And to be frank, it made me nervous $300 ago. And this is NVIDIA trading at $900.
Why are you nervous about it?
Let's just start with their financial performance, okay? 3 years ago, okay, $25 billion in sales. Last year, $55 billion in the year. This year, $110. Amazing, okay? It's a 70-something percent gross margin company. They have 85% market share. It's amazing, okay? Let's be clear on that. So I have never, and you have never, seen anything like this at this scale ever again. If you go back and look at the last major paradigm shift, which was mobile, and Apple wasn't first to it, we all know that, but they made the first device that everybody wanted, and they had 90% of the gross margin, okay, in the entire smartphone industry for years. And think about that, okay? This company in 2009 had like $50 billion in revenue. This company, NVIDIA, just went from 50 to expected 100 plus in 1 year. And when I think about the $1 trillion just this year that has been gained in market cap, it's pulling forward almost every amazing scenario from here on out, in my opinion. So then I think about this stock as the second or third largest market cap company. And I say to myself, okay, it's bringing up a Supermicro. That was a $5 billion market cap company in the Russell 2000 a year ago. Now it's just added at an all-time high. You know what the company does? They sell $2 billion in shares. You want it, investor? You got it, right? Like, so I worry about, we were focused on the concentration of this Mag 7. This is like 6-7 months ago. Now we're worried about the concentration within semis, which is massively outperformed. So I just worry about those sorts of concentrations. They have the ability to break something. That's just a matter of fact. I'm just saying that to you. Okay?
What are you imagining is the thing that could go really wrong if the semis have been great leaders for the market?
It's narratives, right? So think about, we've all gotten comfortable about Microsoft at 35 times because they're going to be a huge beneficiary of Gen AI. Dell Computer, after they reported their last quarter, because the server demand in and around this trend went up 20% like that. Okay, this is not a company that's been on anyone's radar or for the most part in a long time. I think that, so this narrative is broadening out, and that's great. You'd say that diversification is bullish. But then I'd look on the flip side. Broadcom hasn't seen an uptick since they reported about 2 weeks ago. Adobe, this is a company that a lot of folks thought, this is a $250 billion market cap company, since they reported, has barely seen an uptick because the Gen AI stuff is not there. So I just worry that if we were to ever have a recession, if these companies can't commercialize, forget NVIDIA, because everybody wants their product, but their customers, okay? NVIDIA has 40% among Google, Microsoft, Amazon, Meta, all those companies are trying to develop their own GPUs, right? Like, so what I'm saying is we could be on the cusp of something that doesn't look too different than 2000, 2001. And just to quote The Wire here, the game's the same. It's just got more fierce. And the concentration is all those sorts of things. So again, no one can envision this happening. That's the point I'm making to you right now. I still have PTSD from 25 years ago a little bit. Does that make sense to you?
I could totally envision it happening, but I might draw a different conclusion on what it ends up doing to the overall market. Because one of the things that's true about 25 years ago was that if you had a portfolio in anything but tech, by 2001, you were feeling okay.
Yeah.
Then you had 9/11. But then by 2002, if you looked at Berkshire Hathaway, it underperforms the whole way up in the late 90s. They put Buffett on the cover. They laugh in his face.
Yeah.
He's buying Mohawk Industries, which makes carpet. He's buying aluminum siding companies. The stock can't get arrested. But within a year or two of the dot-com crash, Berkshire Hathaway, I think, was making a new record high. So there were...
But it took the NASDAQ 14 years. But the one point I'll just say, so the next leg...
So that's
Josh,
point.
Hold on.
So is your whole portfolio in AI-related names?
But hold on.
Yeah, you might have a problem.
So the next leg of this, and you can call it a bubble, and I hate when people just say, if you use the term bubble, that means that you're calling for like a calamity, a crash, or this or whatever. Like, bubbles can inflate for years. We know that the S&P rallied 30% a year from 1995 through 1999. My point is, it's going to work its way into other industries that are going to be perceived beneficiaries of this technology, and there's going to be all sorts of headlines that come out, and they're going to be buying some industrial stock or some retailer. So what my point is, this goes back to this conversation about valuation. Not a great timing tool, but at some point it might have the ability to distort the rest of the 493 in the S&P 500, and it sets up for, I think, a prolonged period. Think about how orderly
the
sell-off
was. You're
worried
about the non-AI stocks becoming an AI-related bubble?
Well, ultimately, I think that's what happens next.
Well, listen,
if you think that the S&P is going to 6,000 unabated.
So how bullish are you then? Because it hasn't begun yet.
So Dan, higher valuations make the market more fragile.
Yeah.
And can make, if the air comes out of it, it can make for a nasty fall. The reason why I'm not super concerned with NVIDIA today, and I share your concerns that maybe it's pulling forward growth. Of course it is. Let's be real. If the rest of the market were not doing what it was doing,
yeah,
I'd be more concerned. But look at industrials,
look
at materials,
look at
financials.
I get it,
The market is going straight up. So if this was, if NVIDIA and AMD were the only two stocks holding up the market, I'd say this ain't good.
But it's funny, you know, AMD is down 20% in 2 weeks.
Good.
I know, no, I understand. But what I'm saying is, might this be the precursor for it's as good as it gets? Jensen Huang stood out there in front of 16,000 people like a rock star. Okay, think about that. And people were gagging over every word he had to say about a fucking GPU that nobody even knows. Like 98%
of the people
who were not in that arena.
People said the same thing last May after that first blowout quarter that put everyone on notice.
For 6 months, Josh, the stock was...
That's great.
I know,
beautiful.
I know.
But Dan, people said that. But people said that's as good as it gets. They can't do it again.
You know what? You say
then
that.
And they did it again twice.
On January 5th, I went on Fast Money and I said, this stock is about to explode at 490. Okay. Right. Like, okay. But my point is that I get tagged for the guy who's ho-humming everything.
Not by us.
I understand this technology more than 99% of the people. I spend hours a day reading about it. Trust me. Like, I get this stuff. But I also get psychology. And I want to bring you to another huge, like, this was going to be a paradigm shift within the automotive industry. Okay, 3 years ago, Tesla was $1.2 trillion market cap, okay? So they just basically shipped 2 million cars last year. They had the best-selling car the world over in this Model Y, okay? They're going to go X growth this year on deliveries. The stock is down from $400 to $180 or $170 right now, okay? And it pushed the entire global auto industry to move towards a thing that is not working out right now.
It's like
the entire global. And listen, this might be a blip. I get it. But what my point is think about how quickly narratives can shift.
And you're missing your own point.
But look,
you're missing your own point. Tesla just lost $500 billion in market cap.
Who cares?
And the NASDAQ's up 30% at the same time frame.
I'm not missing that point. I'm not trying to broaden
that's
it out.
That's the point.
But I'm talking about narratives in markets. And when
but
narratives in markets
you
come
could break
together.
No. You could break the narrative for a handful of stocks, even if they're really big,
but Josh,
psychologically important stocks.
There was only one EV stock here in the U.S. that incorporated the entire global market cap of autos, okay? So what did GM and Ford? If you look at the charts of Tesla and GM over the last year, it's pretty fascinating. One's up 60% off its lows. The other's down 50% from its highs.
Okay.
And so my only point is, in past bear market cycles, when they've been predicated on these new paradigm shifts, when they come undone, correlations go to one. That's the point I'm trying to make here. And I understand what you're saying. You're looking at one stock that you put way too much importance on relative to what the S&P has done over the time period, which it was added to the S&P in November of 2020 or December 2020. That's when it was actually added into. It's been a train wreck. Tesla's been a horrible stock.
But the market is fine.
I understand.
So who gives a shit? If that happens with NVIDIA, don't you think some of the other companies will be the beneficiary of that lost market cap from NVIDIA? Don't you think you'll see that same shift that you always see?
We'll see. My point is that NVIDIA and Tesla are two very different stories, but the narratives aren't too different.
The narrative
built on cult-like followings, but now what NVIDIA has done, it's literally in 2.5 months. Think about the acceleration from the lows in COVID, okay, in March of 2020 to the highs in 2021. Tesla did gain $1 trillion in market cap. Okay?
But the difference is, Dan, that Tesla was never a narrative for the overall market the way that NVIDIA is, to your point. So if the AI story breaks, because that's what started this bull market, yeah, right? In November 2022. That's what kicked it off, was ChatGPT, OpenAI. Yeah. So if that goes, perhaps it goes to the market. But I guess the reason why we're talking past each other is, so let's say that NVIDIA goes, and let's just say that the market loses some momentum and it gives back 15%. We don't care.
You should. I'm going to tell you why. Because if NVIDIA goes, then the hyperscalers go. Okay, Google Cloud goes. Amazon,
they go
lower because they're the customers, okay? And if they're not being able to actually increase demand for, let's say, first cloud.
We're not scared of bear markets, son.
No, but that's fine. I get it. Listen, guys, when we were still in that bear market that we just talked about a year ago, my advice, if I give it, is just keep dollar cost averaging in the things that are going to be exposed to all these secular trends. And that's what the
QQQ is. Here's a question for you.
Yes.
You're worried about this. It's not an unfounded concern. It's happened before. What do you do about that worry?
I think that
you just keep buying. Not to sound too cavalier, but you just keep buying.
I understand.
You can't control it. So what can you do?
So can I tell you this?
You can
control
yourself.
You guys don't do single stocks at Ritholtz Wealth Management. And you know this. And I know this.
We have thousands of single stocks. We're doing custom indexing.
I understand, but you're not recommending individual names.
Correct.
We're not a brokerage firm.
It's not discretionary stock.
So we're in agreement, Josh.
Yeah.
Okay. But I know, because since I've been doing CNBC, since I've been in the business, so CNBC for 15 years, but in the business in the first 10, fully institutional and no media, I've met thousands of people who think I'm a smart guy about the markets. They come to me and I hear all the fucking stupid things that they do at highs and they do at lows. And they don't know their highs and they don't know their lows, but the psychology is the same. That's the point that I'm trying to make.
Yeah, okay, totally.
I know we agree on that. So what I try to do is just saying, if you want exposure to NVIDIA and this secular trend that's going to have a long tail of decades. It's going to look like the internet of investing in that in the late 90s. And here we are in 2024. The biggest market cap companies in the world are the ones that people were most excited about back then. If that's your view, be careful on the single name. That's what I'm saying.
You're 100% right to tell them that. And I said on television, I feel bad for the people who just learned the NVIDIA story over the last couple of months.
Right.
I feel terrible because they're now coming in really excited about something for which we might have already seen the next 3 years worth of earnings growth
and we're in agreement
priced
on that.
In. I said that literally yesterday. So you and I completely agree about this. I think the difference of opinion is what do you do about it? Because you really can't know if your opinion about how the future is about to shape out is right.
As a pundit, Mike Batnick, I am, again, to answer your question, what do you do about it? I get concerned about the level of confidence that I see on people on CNBC or on the internet about buying NVIDIA right here at $900 at trading at a valuation that has grown into. No, I know. But so, again, I go back to who I am in the markets, who I am as a pundit, and I'm just going to try to lay out how the other
I want to stop you, though. I had debates about the valuation of NVIDIA 5 years ago.
Yeah.
So I had people on the show on a daily, not once, on a daily basis. I think you should buy Intel and not NVIDIA because Intel is 12 times earnings and NVIDIA is 80 times earnings. To which I would say, not in these exact words, go fuck yourself.
Yeah.
These are people that fundamentally had no idea the difference between a CPU and a GPU and certainly couldn't tell you the difference between a training chip and an inferencing chip. And so to have those discussions that start with valuation or start with, look what this stock just did over the last 12 months, you and I both know you're talking to literally a wall. So I don't even engage in it. And now, again, it's scary because you have people coming to the NVIDIA story thinking that they discovered something. And it's like, dude, we are already pricing in this AI revolution and then some. Not egregiously, 34 times forward earnings, but this is definitely not a new story. It's new to you, but it's not new to the investor class. So that is a definite concern. You see it everywhere. I have people come up to me and ask me, what do you think about NVIDIA? What do you think about the earnings? What do you think about this? You feel helpless to help them.
Well, also, look,
they're going to have to learn.
Look at the volume. Look at the volume in NVDL, the 2x levered long NVIDIA thing. That has gone parabolic along with the stock.
Yeah.
So yeah, when people are going to get burned, there's
NVIDIA
no doubt.
NVIDIA is its own casino. It's like $5 billion worth of options volume a day or something. At this point, it's a game.
And that's my point here. I've seen this before. I know how it ends. I don't know from where.
Well, but we don't. We don't know.
But we're going to refresh this, okay? Like hopefully we're going to keep doing these conversations because I really enjoy it. As you can tell, it's very fluid. We literally had a rundown of like 10 topics. I think we covered two of them, which is absolutely amazing.
That's so us.
Yeah, no. But you know what? Listen, let's end it like this. I think that the three of us, including I'm going to throw Guy Adami in here because we've had these conversations with him. We wanted to do this sort of stuff. You guys started writing. I started writing a long time ago because I didn't like the format of having sound bites and being mischaracterized and not being able to go in the level. And you guys have done an amazing job. Mike, you still write. You've stopped writing.
No.
He's back.
I'm once or twice a week now.
Oh, you are?
Yeah.
Okay. That's amazing.
Last thing I wrote, it was out of control.
Okay. So this is on the did you rename the blog or no?
Yeah, it's downtownjoshbrown.com.
Okay, there you go. We're going to plug that. Okay.
Dan, can we give you a present?
Yeah, you can. Okay. Of course you can.
Michael and I wanted to show you a token of our appreciation for just what an all-around mensch you are and you've always been to us.
Thank you, Mike. Can I open it right here?
Of course, do it.
I really appreciate that. I hope we drink this together.
It's a 1999 vintage.
So I didn't want to bring you tequila because you're extremely well-stocked. That's a very good bottle of Italian wine. I assumed I'd be handing it to Guy as well.
Yes, that's amazing.
You two guys pop that. We're gonna pop. Please,
listen. I think our listeners, our viewers, they know how much we appreciate what you guys do. You guys are nonstop at it. And again, when we talk about inspirations, and you guys were talking about Barry first and who inspired us, I was always inspired by the level in which you just engaged with your listeners. Obviously, your clients. This is a big focus of you guys. You guys basically say, "Read us. We're here. We show up every day." You know what I mean? That's really important to us too, and the level of transparency is great. So I appreciate you guys coming back here. I know
of
Guy
course.
Does.
Anytime.
And we're
we'll
huge
come
fans
anytime.
I know. Let's keep doing
hey,
it.
Hey, can we help you name this episode?
Yeah, what do you want
to
do?
I had some ideas.
Let's hear it. Let's
okay.
do
it. NVIDIA, colon, there is no ceiling. Do we like that?
That's fine.
Okay. How about sky's the limit for AI dash Josh Brown.
Are we using, that would be amazing actually, because this goes back to last year when you said Dan Nathan predicts recession. I love that. That was on the Compound and Friends. That was amazing. So
there's no top, Josh and Michael.
No permanently high plateau.
What do you guys
make
take
it
pride?
The never ending rally still to come.
Yeah, it's happening. Hey, one last thing here really quickly. So this goes back to the NVIDIA and the Intel. On a day like today, we wake up, and again, this is kind of telegraphed, but Intel's going to get $8.5 billion in literally a grant and about $11 billion in loans from the government here. Like, the stock is unchanged on the day.
That's chip act stuff.
I know.
It's hilarious that Andy Grove of Intel wrote, "Only the paranoid survive," and they just got smoked.
I know. Liz Young is coming on your pod.
We love
this
Liz.
Week, she just mentioned that book, by the way.
You read it?
On the Monday podcast. No, I haven't. But
phenomenal.
I did read Chip War by Chris Miller. Have you guys read that?
That one I skipped because I heard him on 10 podcasts.
He was on ours too, yeah.
And I said, good. You know what? I probably got the gist
by now.
It's
good, but to the point, like people, Jensen is not some sort of guy who's just come onto the scene. He's been the CEO of NVIDIA for 31 years, and the story of that is in Chip Wars too, so it's really
good.
You
see the size of that chip that he unveiled,
yeah,
though?
It was a pretty big chip. It was pretty hot.
It's like one of those party-sized Tostitos.
Yeah.
You can get a lot of dip on that chip.
I'm just going to say one thing about this is like what's going on right now, the level of interest in this one person, the fawning of the entire tech
industry.
He's a cult figure now?
He's
a cult figure.
Yeah,
and we've seen this before. And my only point is like at some point in 2000, somebody put one too many banner ads on Yahoo and the whole thing came crashing down. It came crashing down from the data centers to Sun Microsystem to the ad tech folks and this and that, whatever. And you can't put your finger on what it exactly was, but it was just like a little too much, a little too fast. But do you think that
you could also say Steve Jobs, there was like a cult, like a huge amount of adoration around him in the mid 2000s, let's say, and it didn't end up being some sort of like a blow up. Even after he passed away, the continuity that Tim Cook came in, the stock tripled.
They hit that paradigm shift. He had set them up for
it.
What are
they? I'm just saying it doesn't always have to end. What I'm saying is that stock's
been cut in half too. Go back and look at, you know, when China was a problem in 2018, that stock was down 50% from its highs, and everybody felt amazing about it at the highs. They felt horrible about it at the lows. You know how many people sold that stock down there?
Yeah.
And Berkshire Hathaway bought it.
Yeah.
But I just feel like it's true. The fact that you have people that don't follow the business news and don't know anything about GPUs are now like fluently talking about Jensen Huang. Yes, it's a moment. And the spotlight's probably too hot. But I'm just saying it doesn't have to become the worst case scenario. It could cool off.
Do you guys pay a monthly fee for a large language model?
No.
When do you think you will start?
We have vendors that are trying to sell us AI solutions.
And you know what they're going to have to do? They're going to actually have to embed it in your current costs. They're going to basically cannibalize whatever that offering
is. They'll raise our
prices. So my point is,
they'll raise our prices.
They're going to try. Okay. And so here's the thing. What if there's not enough demand for it and they've already spent like double, triple ordering these GPUs at $50,000, $60,000?
All right. There's risk to NVIDIA.
No,
we know.
No, but my point is.
I don't know if our vendors are buying GPUs. Our vendors are contracting with Amazon.
Correct.
Web services. But my understanding is they don't have to buy the right to use a server for the rest of their life. It's scale up or down depending
AWS
on their demand.
AWS was growing at 12% the last few quarters. This was the lowest growth that it's ever had. That is the highest margin business for Amazon. So my point is, if there's not consumer or enterprise adoption for these products,
you'll get an air pocket.
You're going to have an air pocket. That's the point I'm making. And that is the similarity to what happened 25 years ago or 24 years ago. And again, I'm not saying it's going to be the same thing. The last point I'll just make about Steve Jobs is that these were consumer products. And it did take a while for them to start to accelerate because you needed the ecosystem built in and around it. What Jensen's promising you right now, the ecosystem's here for you. So they're basically saying, hey, listen, if you spent all last year overspending on H100s, we got a software for that. You're going to pay $5,000 per GPU that's going to get it up to speed. So you don't, maybe right now when we don't have the supply of the Blackwell chips, you're going to be able to upgrade it. Now it's a recurring revenue. Listen, these are all narratives we've all heard before. Yeah. They're all coming together too tightly. And the Jobs thing was different because that was a big paradigm shift that was consumer-led. It wasn't enterprise-led. And enterprise spending comes and goes with all these sorts of trends, with economy, with this sort of thing.
This might be as good as it gets for NVIDIA. We just can't know.
We cannot know. All right, we'll leave it on that. Mike Batnick, Josh Brown, thanks guys for being here. I really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you, Daniel.
Thanks again to our presenting sponsors, CME Group, iConnections, and FactSet. If you like what you heard, make sure you hit follow and leave us a review. It helps other people find the show, and we also want to hear from you. Email us at contact@riskreversal.com. Derivatives are not suitable for all investors and involve the risk of losing more than the amount originally deposited and any profit you might have made. This communication is not a recommendation or offer to buy, sell, or retain any specific investment or service.